Excellent transition to our next speaker. Jeff Hoffman is currently pursuing a PhD at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health in health policy and management. He's currently working on his dissertation, which examines the relationships between the receipt of caregiving and the risk of falls, the temporal ordering of the relationship between falls and emotional distress, and Medicare expenditures associated with fall-related injuries among U.S. older adults. So please welcome Jeff.
Okay, hello. So Dr. Rolfe was talking about the implications of lower income, or actually the prevalence of lower income older adults in the state of California, and I'm actually going to talk about the broad group of Medicare beneficiaries, and actually within the Medicare program, different groups of beneficiaries, sort of broadly speaking, traditional fee-for-service groups versus those with supplementary coverage. And in particular, I'll be looking at the dually eligible group, which policymakers have been focusing on recently. So these are the poorest older adults who can qualify for Medicaid, either through categorical eligibility, through disability pathways, but largely speaking, through lower income. So I have no disclosures. So research has shown, just sort of jumping into it, that as a broad group, even though it's not a homogenous group as I'm going to discuss, that beneficiaries in the Medicare program benefit tremendously in terms of improved access. This is in relationship to employer-based coverage beneficiaries. Fewer access problems, greater utilization, generally speaking. And so as a whole, the program's sort of successful in facilitating access. However, we do know that, as a group, Medicare beneficiaries suffer from lower incomes, as the prior presentation sort of alerted us to. So a natural question arises: across these non-homogeneous Medicare beneficiaries, are those with supplementary coverage incentivized to use more coverage, and is that a good thing? Is that a normatively good thing, or are the people without supplementary coverage not getting appropriate amounts of care? So I thought I'd look into this question. We know from a broad range of research, starting with the 1978 RAND health insurance experiment, that that consumers have sort of elastic responses to increased out-of-pocket expenditures, increased cost-sharing, and by cost-sharing I mean deductibles, premiums, co-insurance, and co-payments. And this can be problematic because it can reduce compliance with medication regimens, it can create problems in terms of reducing not only unnecessary services, but also necessary services. And in particular, out-of-cost burdens are higher, proportionally speaking, in terms of income for those with the lowest incomes. So broadly speaking, if we have a large population of Medicare beneficiaries with lower incomes, this is going to impact the lower income groups relative to the higher income groups. And in Medicare in particular, you have an older age population with increasing complications, chronic conditions, and those with complex treatment decisions are going to have some difficult trade-offs and difficult choices to make with respect to how to spend their out-of-pocket dollars and which ones to use. So just showing, again, the prevalence of lower income amongst the Medicare population, you can see across the country that there is some variation, but broadly speaking, you have a lot of people who are at lower income, and this is the traditional, this is the non-elder index measure, so we can perhaps even double this. And this next slide sort of shows that there's a whole group clumped in the near, what we currently conceive of as the near poverty group, but as Dr. Wallace mentioned, this might be more appropriately described as a poverty group. So what are we talking about when we talk about Medicare costs? Well, the traditional fee-for-service group, which I'm calling the non-supplementary covered group, that's about 10 to 12% of the Medicare beneficiary population. And as many of you know, but I'll briefly summarize, Part A, which covers institutional services, hospital and whatnot, there's an annual deductible, there's coinsurance for each hospital day, but no premium. Part B, which provides access to medical care, physician services, has a sliding scale in terms of monthly premium, but for the lowest income beneficiaries is about $100 a month. That goes up to several hundred dollars a month, $300 or more for those with higher income levels. There's also typically a 20% coinsurance. Coinsurance meaning if you go for a physician visit and it's $80, that's $16 for you, $64 for the Medicare program, right? Now, because of these costs, the reason why you have 88 to 90% of people with supplementary coverage is because they want to help cover these out-of-pocket costs and, again, incentivize people, sort of reverse the typical incentives in the fee-for-service program, which is to allow you greater access to care. Now, those who designed the Medicare program probably wanted the incentives in place to not get unnecessary care, but supplementary insurance sort of blunts these incentives. Now, for those of us in public health, we might think that's a good thing. For fans of decreased utilization, they might not be fans of this approach, but we do have 15% of the beneficiary population are duals. About a quarter use Medicare Advantage plans, but as Dr. Wallace mentions, a lot of variation in that. In San Diego County, I think he said 40%. About a third have wraparound coverage from former employers or unions, and about 15% can buy these standardized plans which provide wraparound coverage. They're called Medigap plans. The dual-eligible population is particularly of interest because they are a small proportion of the overall Medicaid and Medicare populations, but they have disproportionate spending. So these are the so-called high flyers, and particularly there's a group amongst them that are really the high flyers that we need to focus on. We have the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, which are focusing on them. And of interest to this study, those who are below the poverty level are eligible for complete support in terms of out-of-pocket expenditures. All of their premiums, coinsurance, co-payments are covered. If you're slightly above that, up to 120% FPL, your Part B premium's covered, but you're less likely to have coverage for the other sorts of cost sharing. So this is just sort of a breakdown. You can see the percentages that I showed you in the breakdown. And the groups of interest, I'm going to be calling the three groups on the bottom as the Medicare and Other group, or the three groups, Medigap, Medicare Advantage, employer-sponsored, or Medicare and Other is what I will be calling them. The duals, and then the traditional fee-for-service up on top. I can't get into this too much, it'll take too long, but here's a breakdown. Going across, you can sort of see what I've already covered. In the premium row, you can see traditional fee-for-service about $100, but that can go up for higher incomes. For the three groups in the middle, in the three middle columns, you can see that premiums vary across the supplementary coverage groups. And for the duals, as I mentioned, those can be covered by Medicaid. Deductibles also vary considerably, and then the cost sharing is perhaps the most important. You have the 20% coinsurance for traditional fee-for-service, slightly lower. You have co-payments rather than coinsurance for Medicare for MA plans, and then you have slightly lower 15% coinsurance for some of the large employer plans. So you can see sort of gradations. So even though it might seem a little silly of me to sort of clump all these guys in the same group, you can see as classes of beneficiaries, you definitely have differences in terms of the cost sharing. You also have spending limit differences, which are quite important as well. So I hypothesize, this sort of an exploratory project, that presumed cost sharing amongst these groups will account for differences in a utilization metric. And the utilization metric I'm using are self-reported annual physician visits. So duals should have, after adjustment for socioeconomic and health characteristics, they should have a greater number of estimated visits. And the next most number of estimated visits should be that group of Medicare and other beneficiaries, and then traditional fee-for-service last, if that makes sense. Okay? And then the concern with these incentives, if someone else is paying for your out-of-pocket coverage, that there will be moral hazard, you'll use too much. So the question is, will you see greater differences at the lowest income levels? And that's what I hypothesize. Duals have the most help at the lowest income level, so you should see the greatest differences at the lowest income levels. And these differences should persist at all health status categories. So I also used CHIS data. I pulled together 3 years of data, or three waves, rather, looking at older adults, 65 and older. I'll jump through some of these. I am controlling for managed care use in HMO. I used some methods here, which you can see, some interaction terms, and I'll be showing the output in terms of a few tables, but mostly charts and graphs. So the unadjusted results, these sort of play out what I was hypothesizing, which is at the lowest income levels, or overall, you can see that duals use a little more physician care than the other groups, and at the lowest income levels, the differences between the groups are the greatest. And you can also see that, sort of as expected, those in poor health use more care, but the differences are not necessarily as pronounced in the directions that I hypothesized. here are the adjusted results. And in the first row, you can see that compared to dual eligibles, the traditional fee-for-service or Medicare-only group have about 27% fewer estimated visits relative to the dual eligibles, as I said. And the Medicare other group, the other group with supplementary coverage, has about 8% fewer expected visits. So these sort of, again, play out the hypotheses. You can also see that HMO coverage reduces the expected count of visits by about 20%, which is to be expected. In graph form, you see estimated visits are about 30% difference between the two groups. The blue show the difference between Medicare and Medicare-only group and the duals. And then there's about a half a visit difference between Medicare other and the other group. The relative risk of any visit, that is, the likelihood of having a single visit or more, is about 7% lower probability for the traditional fee-for-service group. So not only are they not getting access at all, it's not a question of just not getting access, although they're not getting as much access. It's also, even once they have access, it's not just that they don't have a doctor in the area. Even if they have a doctor, they're not going to see them as much. This is just sort of the distribution of visits to see if perhaps this was just due to a bunch of high flyers and outliers. And you can see, again, that there's skewness to the distribution of visits according to the type of beneficiary. So Medicare traditional fee-for-service beneficiaries are not getting in as much, but even when they do get in, they're using fewer visits, right? And the other groups are a little more skewed towards large amounts of visits. Okay, so I'm just going to show the summary results here. These are the stratified models. So you can see by income, starting with the column that says less than 100% FPL, up to greater than 300% FPL, three columns after that. So the marginal difference in the expected count of visits for the traditional fee-for-service group is about three fewer visits. And remember, the predicted number of visits was about 6.5 for duals. So it's a substantial difference. When you get up to 200% FPL, where the cost sharing is not as high, is not as low for the duals, you see the dramatic sort of swoop down in the marginal difference. So it's about one fewer visit or 0.8 fewer visits. And then as you go up to greater than 300%, it goes down even lower. It's a little bit of a anomaly there because duals shouldn't typically be at high incomes, but you can consider this either misreporting or potentially groups who got in through categorical eligibility pathways. Spend down. Okay. And then the Medicare and other group, you can see the same pattern. It decreases as you go up in income, right? And then across health, you can also see that there are differences. Now, this isn't exactly what I hypothesized. If you had moral hazard, you would expect that the differences would be greater at both poor and excellent health. But here you can see, indeed, when people are in poor health, duals are actually using, who knows, I can't assess if it's appropriate, but certainly the direction is correct of what we would hope to see if they're using the right type of care. Here's in graphic form the same exact thing. So by income, you can see diminishing marginal differences between the traditional group and the other, but a smaller marginal difference between Medicare only, the group that has some supplementary coverage. Poor and excellent health, we've discussed this. So here is just, rather than stratified models, interaction terms, and it's another way to just sort of see the diminishing marginal differences, which I think is interesting. And then one can, you know, surmise whether the difference between the red line and the other two, which is traditional fee-for-service versus the other two, is that because they're underserved, not getting enough treatment due to barriers, or are the other groups getting a little too much? Now, of course, a huge concern with all of this is selection bias, right? So maybe people who have preferences to use more care choose to be in one of the Medicare plans, right? Or they're sick, so they sign up for Medicare Advantage or some plan where they think they're going to get better care. So I also ran treatment effects models which account for unobservables, which could account for some of these differences, and the same results present themselves, so sort of robust to those to those models, but you can never count out issues like that. So in summary, Medicare fee-for-service, the traditional group, are 7 to 13% less likely to have any visit. Compared to duals in terms of the actual estimated visits, they had anywhere from 30 to 40% fewer visits, a substantial amount. For the Medicare and other group, at lower incomes, they're about 20% fewer estimated visits, but they get up back to sort of parity, non-significant differences at higher income levels, as expected. So the results were robust to addressing treatment effects, as I said. So basically, I'll move ahead. So Are duals without support not getting enough care is one potential policy ramification. Are the groups at 200% of FPL, as you see the slope going down in the marginal differences, perhaps, as Dr. Wallace mentioned, these are groups in great need, but we don't give them the premium support and the cost-sharing support. What about traditional fee-for-service? These are groups, many of whom are below 100% FPL, but they don't sign up. They don't take up Medicaid. So will there be spillover from the ACA with all the expansion of Medicaid? Will they somehow go into their doctor and with this any-door policy sort of be up, you know, have greater uptake? Will that be good? Or do we need to do broader outreach? There's a lot of talk in the policy wonk sphere, or whatever you call it, of increasing demand-side pressures to reduce the bend the cost curve. So demand-side would be increased cost-sharing. You have these high-flying dual eligibles. There's a lot of talk about let's bump up the cost-sharing. Or for traditional fee-for-service, let's bump up the cost-sharing. So as I've shown, that could have implications. It seems like these very small differences, remember the differences were $5 in some cases for the coinsurance, 5 percentage points rather, for Medicare and other versus traditional fee-for-service, but you saw the dramatic differences in terms of use of services and access to services. So we also in California have this new initiative, the Coordinated Care Initiative, which we're going to be enrolling our duals into managed care. And as I showed, there was 20% lower expected count of visits for those enrolled in managed care. So that also has implications. Now, that may be a good thing. Duals may have poor managed care, but it's something to consider. So there are a lot of limitations. This is presumed cost sharing. I did not have a measure of that. But I think we did the best we could to account for to try to see what was going on in the Medicare program. So that's it.
So we'll take questions currently for this, for Jeff. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Did you look at the medical debt variable at all? Was that a mistake? Because it's in one of the grants they've got. Do you have?
I didn't see that. No, if that's in there, I'd love to see that. They had, the only things that I could see on cost sharing were deductibles, over 1,000, over 2,000, and that just sort of destroyed power and didn't tell me as much as I wanted to know, but there's a medical debt one. Okay, wonderful. Is that in, going back to 2007?
No.
It's in the new one. Okay, fabulous. Anyone else? I know that was a lot, yeah. Sorry, can you restate the question?
Usually in younger population, the more you utilize self-care, the presumption is that that's sicker.
Right, and is that the same case if you have preventive wellness care? Well, it's interesting. I'm not entirely sure what the answer to the question is, but I do know that in some of the beneficiary groups, wellness visits in the past weren't covered for free, but now they're beginning to be covered for free. So those might be a question I'll be able to suss out in the future. You know, bear in mind there are tremendous differences. I mean, obviously, the MA plans specifically seek out healthier populations, right? And then they give them free wellness visits and gym memberships. So presumably, yeah, they're going to be getting visits through those pathways. But there's also a lot of gatekeeping and utilization review in those groups and restricted networks. Whereas traditional fee-for-service, you know, they're still going to be facing the 20%, typically 20% coinsurance payment. So that stays there for them, whereas there might be more generous policies for wellness visits, but it varies tremendously across the, you know, the Medigap plans and the employer-sponsored wraparound plans. For duals, these are just—it's a really sick group. I mean, it's a really tremendously different group than everyone else, so it's hard to compare, which is sort of why I wanted to look into this. But yeah, I don't know. It's a great question. Anyone else?
Okay. Thank you.